We are continuing today, or I guess resuming today, our study of the book of Romans. Second part of Romans chapter 15. Book of Romans, we are coming to a close of our study of that, and consistent with our habit or our pattern of bouncing back and forth between the Old and New Covenant in our study, I think the next book we will undertake, and starting the second half of the month, is the book of Hosea. Would be our next target after the book of Romans. But before we actually looked at the text of second part of Romans chapter 15, I wanted to read to you 10 ways to avoid becoming a missionary. A tongue-in-cheek look at some surefire ways to avoid becoming a missionary. And this is off of the Southern Nazarene University website. So 10 ways to avoid becoming a missionary. Way number one, ignore Yeshua's request in John 4:35 that we take a long, hard look at the fields. Seeing the needs of people can be depressing and very unsettling. It could lead to genuine missionary concern. Two, focus your energies on socially legitimate targets. Remember, these are ways not to become a missionary. Go after a bigger salary. Focus on getting a job promotion, a bigger home, more luxurious car, or future financial security. Along the way, run up some big credit card debts. Three, get married to somebody who thinks the Great Commission is what your employer gives you after you make a big sale. After marriage, embrace the socially accepted norms of settling down, establishing a respectable career trajectory, and raising a picture-perfect family. Way number four, stay away from missionaries. Their testimonies can be disturbing. The situations they describe will distract you from embracing wholeheartedly the materialistic lifestyle of your home country. Five, if you happen to think about missions, restrict your attention to countries where it's impossible to openly do missionary work. Think only about North Korea, Saudi Arabia, China, and other closed countries. Forget the vast areas of our globe open to missionaries. Never, never listen to talk about creative access countries. Six, think how bad a missionary you would be based on your own past failures. It is unreasonable to expect you will ever be any better. Don't even think about Moses, David, Jonah, Peter, or Mark, all of whom overcame failures. Seven, always imagine missionaries as talented, super spiritual people who stand on lofty pedestals. Maintaining this image of missionaries will heighten your own sense of inadequacy. Convincing yourself that God does not use ordinary people as missionaries will smother any guilt you may feel about refusing to even listen for a call from God. By the way, that's one interesting thing about Bob Bugenhagen, that Sharon grew up with him. And so it's like, ooh, you know, somebody you know that becomes a missionary. And at my work, there was somebody that I worked with, a technician there, who decided that he was going to become a missionary to Tibet, which is no easy mission field. And so it is not your... I mean, it's not like these people were walking around with their feet never touching the ground with halos around their head their entire lives. They were just, you know, ordinary people like you and like me. Way number eight. Agree with the people who tell you that you are indispensable where you are. Listen when they tell you that your local church or home country can't do without you. Nine, worry incessantly about money. 10, if you still feel you must go, go out right away without any preparation for training. You'll soon be home again, and no one can ever blame you for not trying. And I have seen that. I have seen missionaries run out to the field without any preparation whatsoever, and then being surprised when they washed out and wound up back home. In a very short period of time. A matter of months sometimes. They're back. So what in the world does this have to do with Romans? Turn me to Romans chapter 15. And we will talk here about one of the greatest missionaries in history, which is the Apostle Paul, and what he had to say about being a missionary. We already did the first part of chapter 15, and now we're down in verse 18. But let's get a running start. Let's go back to verse 17. Therefore, in Messiah Yeshua, I have found reason for boasting in things pertaining to God, for I will not presume to speak of anything except what Messiah has accomplished through me, resulting in the obedience of the Gentiles by word and deed, in the power of signs and wonders, in the power of the Spirit, so that from Jerusalem and round about as far as Illyricum, I have fully preached the gospel of Messiah. Man, I'm going to stop back and say, how many people in our time and place can say that? Because oftentimes what we have built our churches and our enterprises on is not the power of the Messiah to change lives, but rather upon the ability of people to cleverly do things. I mean, there are places out there that you can go to that can give you seminars on promoting your church or congregation. They can give you assistance on fundraising. They can give you assistance on practically anything. Training courses, tapes, books, all sorts of things that you can buy and that you can use. And now I'm not saying that some degree of organization isn't essential. You don't want to have a large congregation, you know, a congregation of hundreds of people that behaves like a cloud of gnats, always bumping into each other, never going anywhere. But you also don't want to have things so well organized that you call into the church and you get into an automated attendant that you have to swim down through it. Frank Peretti wrote a book called The Visitation, and although there are things about that book that make me uncomfortable, one of the things that soured one of the characters that became one of the greatest evil characters in the book on fellowshipping with other believers was his experience with his church. And one of the characters in the church tries to call and talk to the pastor of that church about the trouble this particular individual is calling. He gets caught in automated attendant limbo where he keeps swimming back and forth and keeps being passed back and forth from person to person, never really reaching the person he needed to talk to. And oftentimes, we structure our organizations like that, that the corporations that we have, as far as my understanding, the organization of corporations, were brought about as sort of an imitator of the way churches were organized. And now churches want to go back and organize themselves over this inferior copy, which is how corporations run. And so we structure ourselves as a gigantic business enterprise, far separated from either the power of the Messiah or the people that we serve. And Paul said that the battery that powered his ministry was not his own skills or his own upbringing, because he could have boasted about either of those. Paul was a well-educated, rising star in the rabbinical community, a pupil of Gamaliel, who was one of the heavy hitters. If you open up the book that is used in Jewish culture, the Talmud, you could find some of the sayings of Gamaliel in the Talmud. I mean, he was a heavy hitter. He was a very important person. It's like studying physics under Einstein is like studying Judaism under Gamaliel, and Paul could have boasted about that here, but he didn't. He said it was the power of the Messiah. The power of the Messiah working through him, reaching hearts and working miracles. Although you look at Paul's life, that he did not build his ministry around what we would consider to be the sign miracles. I mean, although there were things that happened in his life where people got healed and things happened, into every city that he went, there is no evidence that he held a healing service or he did any kind of sort of miracles in every city. But in a lot of the cities, when he's talking about the power of the Spirit, he's talking about the power of the Spirit to convict people of their sin and drive them to the Messiah. That he would preach and people would come around. Other places he would preach and plant a seed, come back later, and it was blossoming. Verse 20, "And thus I aspired to preach the gospel, not where Messiah was already named, so that I would not build on another man's foundation. But as it is written, he who had no news of him shall see, and they who have not heard shall understand. For this reason I have often been prevented from coming to you." In other words, the rigors of the work. When you look at big churches today, some of them have actually been effective in the community. Other big churches, I would say probably the majority of big churches, you start talking to people in them and say, "Well, how did you come to know the Lord? How did you come to Messiah?" Well, I became a believer over in that church or over in that town. And so a lot of the big churches or congregations gain a lot of their membership through sheep stealing. You know, it's like just shuffling around the believers without any great impact upon the communities around us. And even the believers that are there develop the entertainment mentality that, well, if you stop entertaining me, then it's like going to the movies, that, well, if I don't like this movie, I can get up and there's a theater right next door that's playing a better movie. And a lot of people treat their life as a believer in that way. But what Paul said is, not me. I'm going out where people have never heard a word. And there's still a need for that. I think I read, when I was preparing for this, that they call it the 1040 corridor. And what it is between the 10th and 40th parallel. That if you look at it on a map, that covers the North Africa, North Africa, going across the Middle East into Southeast Asia and Indonesia. And that particular corridor, I think, in that corridor, there's something like 3.2 billion people, out of which 95% of them have not heard the gospel even once. Not even once. I mean, that's the ministry, right, I've talked about, the Bugenhagens. They are ministering kind of at the bottom corner of that corridor down in Papua New Guinea among the indigenous peoples and the native languages. But there's just tons of people, even in places that are not considered third world, but considered now up and coming, like India or southern part of China. The people just not heard the gospel. So there's still a lot of work out there. Sitting here in America, we think, well, what's the sense? Everybody knows. Or maybe in this country, everybody knows, or everybody could know if they just turn on the radio. Or just in the bookstore, turn around from this shelf on the left, which says New Age, and just turn around to the right where it says Bibles. Maybe they know. So in this country, it's not like it's far away from people. Sometimes it's just the next station over on the radio dial and they can hear it. I mean, you go from, I don't know what exact station, 97 point something, the rock station is in this area, and just go down to 95 something, you get the Christian radio station. It's like, it's not that far off from each other, that in this country that either people have heard or there is the option for hearing very easily. Now in the Jewish community, it's people have the option to hear, but after about the third word, they shut the radio off. So there's a little bit different there. But Paul's attitude was to preach where it had never been heard before, which is a great joy, but also a great burden. You know, I mentioned about the Bob Bugenhagen, and before he went out on the field, one of the things that he mentioned, it wasn't original with him, but I don't remember where he got it from, is one of the great problems that believers have in this country is we inoculate people against the gospel. And what it means by that is that we give it to them. If you ever know about how you develop immunity for allergies, for instance, because I used to take allergy shots, and the way you do allergy shots is the stuff that makes you sick, the pollen or whatever, you dilute it way down. And you give a person a shot. And you get a little bit of a reaction, but nothing very big. So you increase the dosage the next time. And over a period of weeks or months, you build up the dosage and you build up a tolerance to it, and you inoculate people against that particular substance so that it no longer bothers them. I think in this country, that was the phrase about inoculating people about the gospel, that initially when people hear it is so watered down that it's unrecognizable, so that by the time you get to talk about it, people are just insensitive to their own need. I remember one time when I was working at the Baltimore Sun, I sat down at a table and I was sharing the gospel with a coworker, and there was a believer sitting there too. And I was just, you know, talking about the gospel and whatever. And I got to the end. Usually when you give a gospel presentation, when it's not just a long-term friendship sort of thing, but when you're sitting down and you finally can actually talk about it, your question is, well, okay, the diagnostic question, if you die tonight, would you go to heaven? And if you were to die tonight and stand before God, and God would say to you, why should I let you in, what would you say? And of course, as soon as I got to that point, the well-meaning believer next to me chimes in and says, well, because I've been, you know, saved by the blood. And the woman across from me that I was trying to share with said, yeah, what he said. So it was obvious she didn't really think that. But now it's like on the test, the teacher accidentally gave the correct answer. And so now all the students are going to write it down, even though they hadn't read the chapter. And so she was going to write that down. So she was inoculated at that point against any further conversation because she knew the answer that was expected. And so she didn't let the question bother her. So one of the joys about being in the mission field among people who had never heard it before is that they have not been inoculated against it. So that when they hear it, there are these great outpourings of joy that there is no doubt in your mind that these people have made a genuine profession. That's the other problem we have in this country. That the gospel, it's not like the gospel, but there are various watered down things that aren't really the gospel, leading up to really the gospel, that people can get these watered down things stuck in their mind, and when they hear the true gospel, that is that all men are sinners, all men are in need of Redeemer, that you have to commit yourself absolutely and utterly to that relationship with the Messiah and anything that he demands of you, that because they've been inoculated with these other messages, when they hear this other message, they say, yeah, that's what I believe. Well, kind of, sort of. That's essentially what I believe. That's pretty much what I believe. But it's like saying to somebody, well, you know, I need you to drive from here to, you know, Colorado. And they say, you give them the directions. And they don't take the right way. They don't get on Route 70. They get on Route 95 instead, and they say, well, I'm essentially going in that general direction, or you're going Route 83, and you're like, well, wait a minute, you're not even going anywhere near Colorado. You're going to wind up, who knows where, upstate New York or whatever, you're not going to wind up even anywhere close to it. And that's the same way the gospel is. If you start off a little bit askew, you're not going to wind up anywhere close when you're done. So when you're dealing with somebody who has never heard, you can lay that foundation. Russia, when it opened up after communism, was a very fruitful mission field because people could rush right in and the people knew absolutely nothing about what it truly meant to be a believer. So they could start from scratch. Of course, after that initial door opened and the believers rushed in, they were followed almost immediately afterwards by the cults who followed afterwards and immediately sowed other seeds of error behind them. So now Russia is a mess, but China is not so much as a mess because the people who aren't true are scared to go in there, whereas the people who are believers, they go in anyway. So China is not so much as a mess, but Russia is a mess in terms of knowledge. So the joy is you can start from scratch. There's no preconception. You can see immediately the working of the Spirit. There is no doubt that these people have really and truly understood what it means to become a believer, and they commit themselves absolutely and completely unto the Lord. However, on the other side of things, you have to start from scratch. You really have to start from scratch when you're doing ministry missions out in the field for people who had never heard. It's similar to what Paul went through. I mean, we think of missions, we think of, you know, going to downtown Baltimore during a ball game or something like that as doing evangelism. But this is the sort of thing where he was dealing with people that you would encounter in tribal work or in work in Southeast Asia, people had no idea that there was one God. So you kind of have to start from that idea that there is one God, and the notion of sin and the notion of obedience to God and the notion of holiness, and start from scratch. And we had some letters back and forth that in the area in which they are ministering, they don't have bread. Well, they don't have bread like we know bread. They have a root that they grind up and kind of bake. So I guess it would be more like a hash brown than like bread, really. It's something that's a substance that doesn't rise. So how do you deal with all the issues about a little bit of leaven? Leaven's a, a whole lump and the bread of life and all the rest of that. And it's a tough thing. It's a tough thing. But it's something that over the years God has worked out, that now in many of these places that they are now spreading God's word, the harvest is bountiful. There are people in villages, things where people were basically animists, or worshiping the spirit of ancestors, or worshiping animals or trees, that now they are in a full knowledge and acceptance of Yeshua. So there is great joy in going where no one has gone before, forgive me, and going into untouched territory and reaching out to these different unreached peoples. And don't think the work is almost done either. I mean, yeah, they're making great progress, but there's still great need for missionaries to go out. And there, I think Wycliffe, I think at one estimate there were 6,000 language groups that were still unreached. And I think the figure I last saw was that you're thinking, oh, all right, these little, piddly language groups of 1,000, 2,000, 10,000 people, what's the sense? When you add up all the people in those miscellaneous tribal language groups, you wind up with 142 million people. So it's a sizable amount of people. So there is still a great deal of work to be done in terms of going, in terms of supporting, in terms of praying, in terms of helping, however way you can, the work that they're doing out in the field. And just a simple letter back and forth to say, we're praying for you, we know about you, we're supportive of your work, how's it going? Don't think that missionaries are immune from struggles, that once again, the golden aura of somebody drifting above the ground, that I know when a couple of missionaries have gone out to the mission fields, that it has been a struggle. Struggle with relationships with other missionaries, with their home office, and with the peoples they're trying to reach. It's a tough thing to go out in a village and not have any Christian fellowship whatsoever. I mean, they try to send them out as families or as groups, a couple of people. Because of that there is no form of Christian fellowship. No Christian radio. I mean, now at least you have the email, but back or even 20 years ago, the only way you could write back and forth to missionaries by letters. And the letter took 10 days to arrive, and then 10 days for the reply to come. So you're talking about almost 3 weeks to have an interaction with letters back and forth. Now it's like a matter of minutes if they're in the translation center. If they're in the village, it's still going to take a while. But that was Paul's idea, and there are also the idea of many today, to go where the gospel has never been heard before, and maybe that's your idea too, and it is still possible and it's still feasible. People, missionary groups will welcome you with open arms. But remember way number 10. Okay? God calls people into missionary work, but that doesn't mean they just pack up their stuff in a truck and head for the plane. It means God calls you to preparation in order to have the skills required to do the missionary work. If God called me to minister to pilots, I wouldn't just show up at the airfield and say, okay, take me to a plane, God has called me to be a pilot. There's laws against that. And I'd have to prepare myself to be a pilot, to minister to a pilot. So I'm saying a missionary translation work or tribal work is no different. No different. Verse 23, but now with no further place for me in these regions, and since I have had for many years a longing to come to you, I wanted to stop there because somebody pointed out the honesty of Paul to admit that he didn't have anything more to do. He set out that God had called him to reach these certain areas. He reached them. He planted congregations, churches, congregations, whatever. They had their own leadership. They were running things smoothly. He was done. So he said, I don't have anything to do. I got free time on my hands. So now I can come visit you. He said before that I was too busy planning stuff, but now I'm done. Now I'm done. Now I'm ready to come see you and maybe go on a little further. That is really the goal of missions work. The goal of missions work, tribal missions, or missions, foreign missions, is to plant a church or congregations so that the people there can take over the leadership. You don't want to develop people who are dependent on the mission group. You want them to be independent. You want to build a solid group with their own leadership, their own elders and deacons, that they can take over and that they can run things. Then you're on to the next village or on to the next language group. Verse 24, whenever I go to Spain, for I hope to see you in passing and to be helped on my way there by you, when I have first enjoyed your company for a while, but now I am going to Jerusalem serving the saints. From Macedonia and Achaia I have been pleased to make a contribution for the poor among the saints in Jerusalem. This is written about in other places in Paul's writings, that there was a lot of issues in Jerusalem with the believers being poor. It's not certain exactly what was going on, but basically they'd used up their resources, and Paul had collected contributions from the other churches that he had planted around in the area, and he was going to take the contribution back to Jerusalem. But notice his plans in verse 24. He was going to go take the stuff back to Jerusalem, and since he had nothing more to do in Macedonia and Achaia, he was then going to stop by at Rome and see if they would help pay his way to go on to Spain. Because even in Roman times, there was a lot of Roman presence in Spain, and there was a lot of Jewish presence among the people in Spain. Even up until the 15th century, there was a fairly large Jewish presence in Spain. So he was going to go minister in Spain. And he figured, well, go to Jerusalem, drop this stuff off, and then on my way by, I'm going to come see you. We'll get back to that point in a minute, because I want you to kind of get in mind his plans. Verse 26, for Macedonia and Achaia have been pleased to make a contribution for the poor among the saints in Jerusalem. Yes, they were pleased to do so, and they are indebted to them. For if the Gentiles have shared in their spiritual things, they are indebted to minister to them, and also in material things. Therefore, when I have finished this, and have put my seal on this fruit of theirs, I will go by way of you to Spain. I wish the church today would have this attitude towards the Jewish community, but they don't. Haven't had it for centuries. You turn back to seeing what sort of terrible things the church did to the Jewish people in the Middle Ages, and this gratefulness for spiritual things certainly did not last very long at all. It turned into hatred and persecution and all sorts of miserable things. But there was kind of this idea of mutual concern that spiritual things and material things, that there would be this correspondence that one for the other. And once again, his plans in verse 28 was that he was going to go drop off the gift and come visit them on the way to Spain. Did it work out that way? No. It didn't work out that way at all. God still brought him to Rome, but not exactly the way he had planned. When someone is in motion for God, God can still use that person, although God controls the plan. What happened was, Paul took the gift back to Jerusalem, all right. He arrived at Jerusalem. There was such an uproar in the temple when he showed up there that he wound up getting arrested and brought before Festus, and then he made the appeal to the emperor. As a Roman citizen, he had that right. So he wound up going to Rome under arrest. And as a Roman citizen, he was able to have some freedom of movement and able to encourage and build up the community in Rome, but certainly not this little stay, this rest stop on his way to Spain, that God was still able to use him, that even Paul wound up having things not exactly go the way he planned. Sometimes we read about these people and we think, oh, everything went their way. They never had anything go awry. They never had any plans disturbed. Everything was just smooth sailing. No, didn't happen to Paul. Didn't have this nice little trip through Rome, but he wound up there in a house, under arrest, But during that time, he was able to be a blessing to them. Verse 29, I know that when I come to you, I will come in the fullness of the blessing of Messiah. He was absolutely right. He just didn't show up the way he expected. He was a great blessing to the community. But he didn't wind up exactly the way he had planned. Sometimes God does that. Oftentimes God does that. We have our plans. We have what we want to do. And instead, God does what, from a worldly perspective, is turning things upside down, but it still winds up from God's glory. How many of you have ever heard of William Borden? Nobody's heard of William Borden. In 1904, William Borden graduated from a Chicago high school. As heir to the Borden Dairy Estate, he was already a millionaire. For his high school graduation present, his parents gave the 16-year-old Borden a trip around the world. As the young man traveled through Asia, the Middle East, and Europe, he felt a growing burden for the world's hurting people. Finally, Bill Borden wrote home to say, I'm going to give my life to prepare for the mission field. One friend expressed surprise that he was throwing himself away as a missionary. In response, Bill wrote two words in the back of his Bible, no reserves. Even though young Borden was wealthy, he arrived on the campus of Yale University in 1905, trying to look like just one more freshman. Very quickly, however, Borden's classmates noticed something unusual about him, and it wasn't his money. One of them wrote, he came to college far ahead spiritually of any of us. He had already given his heart in full surrender to Messiah and had really done it. We who were his classmates learned to lean on him and find in him a strength that was solid as a rock, just because of his settled purpose and consecration. During his college years, Bill Borden made one entry in his personal journal that defined what his classmates were seeing in him. That entry said simply, say no to self and yes to Yeshua every time. Borden's first disappointment at Yale came when the university president spoke on the students' need of having a fixed purpose. After hearing that speech, Borden wrote, he neglected to say what our purpose should be and where we should get the ability to persevere and the strength to resist temptations. Surveying the Yale faculty and much of the student body, Borden lamented what he saw as the end result of this empty philosophy, moral weakness and sin ruined lives. Don't think it's just our day and time. That's my note, not this from this passage. During his first semester at Yale, Borden started something that would transform campus life. One of his friends described how it happened. It was well in the first term when Bill and I began to pray together in the morning before breakfast. I cannot say positively whose suggestion it was, but I feel sure it must have originated with Bill. We had been meeting only a short time when a third student joined us, and soon after a fourth. The time was spent in prayer after a brief reading of Scripture. Bill's handling of Scripture was helpful. He would read to us from the Bible, show us something that God had promised, and then proceed to claim the promise with assurance. Borden's small morning prayer group gave birth to a movement that spread across the campus. By the end of his first year, 150 freshmen were meeting for weekly Bible study and prayer. By the time Bill Borden was a senior, 1,000 of Yale's 1,300 students were meeting in such groups. Borden made it his habit to seek out the most incorrigible students and try to bring them to salvation. In his sophomore year, we organized Bible study groups and divided up the class of 300 or more, each man interested taking a certain number so that all might, if possible, be reached. The names were gone over one by one, and the question asked, who will take this person? When it came to someone thought to be a hard proposition, there would be an ominous pause. Nobody wanted the responsibility. Then Bill's voice would be heard, put him down to me. Borden's outreach ministry was not confined to the Yale campus. He cared about widows and orphans and cripples. He rescued drunks from the streets of New Haven. To rehabilitate them, he founded the Yale Hope Mission. One of his friends wrote that he might often be found in the lower parts of the city at night, on the street, in a cheap lodging house or some restaurant, to which he had taken a poor hungry fellow to feed him, seeking to lead him to Messiah. Borden's missionary call now narrowed to the Muslim Kanzu people in China. Once that goal was in sight, Borden never wavered. He also inspired his classmates to consider missionary service. One of them said, he certainly was one of the strongest characters I have ever known, and he put backbone into the rest of us at college. There was real iron in him, and I always felt he was the stuff martyrs were made of, and heroic missionaries of more modern times. Although he was a millionaire, Bill seemed to realize always that he must be about his father's business and not wasting time in the pursuit of amusement. Although Borden refused to join a fraternity, he did more with his classmates in his senior year than ever before. He presided over the huge student missionary conference held at Yale and served as president of the Honor Society Phi Beta Kappa. Upon graduation from Yale, Borden turned down some high-paying job offers. In his Bible, he wrote two more words, no retreats. William Borden went on to graduate work at Princeton Seminary in New Jersey. When he finished his studies at Princeton, he sailed for China. Because he was hoping to work with Muslims, he stopped first in Egypt to study Arabic. While he was there, he contracted spinal meningitis. Within a month, 25-year-old William Borden was dead. When news of William Whiting Borden's death was cabled back to the U.S., the story was carried by nearly every American newspaper. A wave of sorrow went around the world. Borden not only gave away his wealth, but himself in a way so joyous and natural that it seemed a privilege rather than a sacrifice, wrote Mary Taylor in her introduction to his biography. Was Borden's untimely death a waste? Not in God's plan. Prior to his death, Borden had written two more words in his Bible. Underneath the words, no reserves and no retreats, he had written, no regrets. There was a man that God used, although he certainly didn't work out the way he planned, did it? Sometimes we look at our own lives and we say, well, what's the use or what's the purpose? I'm sure Paul would look at it and say, would be tempted to say, rather, how did I wind up in jail? What happened to all these other places I want to be? But God has his own plans and his own ways that glorify the name of God. Verse 30, now I urge you, brethren, by our Lord Yeshua the Messiah, and by the love of the Spirit, to strive together with me in your prayers to God for me, that I may be rescued from those who are disobedient in Judea, and that my service for Jerusalem may prove acceptable to the saints, so that I may come to you in joy by the will of God and find refreshing rest in your company. Now the God of peace be with you all. Amen. By the way, that piece was also from the Southern Nazarene University. Borden is known far beyond that, by the way. So Paul ends with a plea to stand with him in prayer. Because even Paul, with all the rest of the things going on, understood that it was only the power of God that allowed him to do anything. And we need, first of all, to pray for missionaries and not forget. I mean, pray for them. Put them on your prayer list. Pick some missionaries. Put them on your prayer list. Pray for them because they have a very difficult thing. Pray for me. Pray for me that I might be rescued from those who seek to damage me or this congregation. Pray for each other that you might be rescued from those who are disobedient. And in so doing, you strive together with these people. I mean, nobody who is a believer is a lone ranger. Or shall I say, nobody who is a believer who is successful is a lone ranger. That there are always multitudes of people who are standing behind you who ought to be praying for you. I mean, there have been places in my life where I've been heading for a difficult situation, and all of a sudden it cleared up, and I said, well, what just happened there? Only to find out that someone was praying for me or for it, and it all worked out. This whole great enterprise, sometimes we think that making a lot of money and having nice things and having fun is our job, and our service to God is our hobby, sort of our spare time activity. But it becomes very evident in the life of Paul, and becomes very evident in the testimony of those who have gone before us, that our heart and our life needs to be focused, sort of like a magnifying glass. If you take a magnifying glass in the sunlight and you hold a piece of paper under it, then you get a bright spot on it. Yeah, okay, it's a bright spot. But if you want to burn through that paper, you got to focus it. It's your own life. I mean, as believers, we're gonna leave a bright spot on this world. But are we going to really set it afire? We're not, unless we're focused. If we're focused on God, on the pursuit of our Messiah, against all odds, and against all obstacles, standing with each other in prayer, with our heads in the right place, then we will be focused. And that which we are and that which we do will be pleasing to God, no matter what the earthly success looks like. You know, from the earthly standpoint, you look at Paul and you say, wind up in jail. You know, what a loser. But yet here we are 2,000 years later reading his words. And the impact that he made was outstanding, even at the times he was in jail. Read about people like William Borden and about Little. I forget his first name. Eric Little. Thank you. And the things that he accomplished. He also died relatively young in China. The things that other people have accomplished that from human standpoint look like they're not all that successful, yet in God's eyes, if we are focused, we will have success in God's eyes. But we are so unfocused, we are so spread out into all sorts of things that don't matter, are harmful, that it's a miracle that God can use any of us at all to accomplish anything at all. Let's pray. Dearest God and Father, forgive us for running every which way, for building our own kingdoms by our own strength and in our own ways, for focusing on things that were not important, or not focusing at all. Father, I thank you for the dedication of these men like Paul and Borden and Little and Wycliffe and all the rest, who at great peril to their own lives, sometimes even losing their lives, they transmitted your word from generation to generation, place to place. Father, forgive us that we are so weak and so ineffectual. Teach us to lift our eyes towards you and to build our lives on you and for you and in you, and not any place or any way or for any other reason than the glory of our Messiah Yeshua. Amen.